אתם עם SBS בעברית. לעוד סיפורים מעניינים, כנסו ל-sbs.com.au.
Hello, Sonia. Welcome to SBS.
Thank you, Marielle, for having me.
As someone who has been in the diamond industry for so many years, I myself am so fascinated by you because I've been following you for so long. There are a few things that I want to cover with you. First and foremost, you were the editor-in-chief of Rappaport magazine, and for anyone in the jewelry trade, specifically the diamond trade, that is such a big deal. Do you want to tell us a little bit about Rappaport and the effect it has on the market?
For sure. So Rappaport was founded, the company that was founded 46 years ago by Martin Rappaport. Martin Rappaport is an American businessman, started in diamond industry in Antwerp as a cleaver, went back to New York to be a dealer. And he had this realization in the 70s that everyone could do the prices they wanted. So a diamond could be sold for any price depending on who was selling it. And he noticed the lack of transparency was creating big problems in the industry, in the trust in the industry, and also among retailers, because they could be sold the same diamond for very, very different prices. So Martin, having studied economy in Israel, he studied in his 20s, he was a student in Israel here, decided to create a system called the price list. So the price list launched in 1976, exactly. And people hated him for that because suddenly the prices of diamonds, different shape, different sizes, but the most commonly bought diamonds, round shapes, pear shapes, were officially known. So, and every week you had a price list with the fluctuations of the prices. And there's this famous story that Martin walked the streets of New York with a bulletproof jacket because people really were so angry at him. They accused him of destroying the industry, of undermining dealers. So he didn't get a good rap, pun intended on that one. But the rap list was created and the whole system created at the end of the 70s. On the back of that, he wanted to add information and context to the price list. So the price list suddenly was published with a few pages, very rudimentary, black and white, a few news story analysis on the market. Martin used to be a very good writer as well, pick up on subjects that was of interest for the industry. And this price list with these few pages grew into a magazine, a glossy magazine that was published for 20 odd years, I think, before I took over. Took it in 2017, and that was a very interesting shift because the magazine had been published in New York since then, and finally we moved all the editorial operations to Israel. So that became an Israeli-produced magazine with the operations, editorial team. Most of the news reporters were in Israel. Big names like Avi Kravitz, Joshua Friedman, have been covering the diamond industry for a long time. So that was mostly it. That's the story of the price list. That's still the core product. It's very famous if you're a retailer. Most retailers will have this little red sheet on their desk or behind their desk. Diamond dealers have it. Obviously, there's been a lot of new competitors. There's been, but very much most people still follow the price list. It's the natural diamond price list. It's very important to say it. So that's what gives the prices for the natural diamond market. And when lab-grown diamonds, which means they're created in the factory, but they have the same physical features as a natural diamond, the prices of the lab-grown were calculated against the wrap list, the wrap-apple price list, which made crazy things like, you know, 70% less, 90%, 99 ones, which is also a funny thing. So it's still kind of the standard for the diamond industry. That's the price list.
I've worked in the diamond trade both in Australia and abroad, and the Rappaport price list is infamous and it's absolutely everywhere. Just to recap on what you've said, it indicates the prices at which you buy and which you sell the diamonds. It's a sort of parameter, so anyone in the trade would use it. I'd like to ask you a question for the people in the market for a natural diamond versus a lab-grown diamond. You must get this all the time. Are the lab-growns going well, and is it worth buying a lab-grown over a natural diamond or the other way around?
So So here I'm not the editor-in-chief of Rappaport anymore. So the position of Rappaport has always been against lab-grown diamond. I just want to be very clear. Martin has spoken against lab-grown diamonds since for as long as I can remember.
Tell us why.
Because he thinks that people have been lying to the consumers because a lab-grown diamond is produced en masse. So it means that if you have a natural diamond that is mined, it costs a certain amount of money and is you have a certain level of rarity. You know, the rarity may be not as rare as, you know, is being publicized and marketed for decades, but let's say it's still rare and difficult to find a specific diamond. A lab-grown diamond will be created in a vat, in a factory, so you can create as many as you want, in the size you want, the clarity, the cut will come after. But the quality of your diamond in the lab, you can have millions of them, really, if you want it. So, and then suddenly they're on the market, and it's almost the price difference between a natural and a lab-grown wasn't so different for a long time when their value is very different. Because if you have something that is rare and something that's mass-produced, it shouldn't be sold with only 20% difference. There's the other thing that is, which I think it's a legit argument. You know, if you can have a diamond for $100, what would you charge for it? $2,000, you know? So when the natural would cost $5 or $6, by the way, I just want to put things in perspective here.
Absolutely. Now,
the consumer, let's think of the consumer. A consumer wants a beautiful ring and a big ring, especially in America. People love 2 carats to 3 carats. I don't know in Australia what's the trend, but the Americans, they really like their diamonds to be big. Yeah. And if they can't afford a natural 2 carat to 3 carat stone, but they can afford a lab grown, I'll be the first one to say go for it. Yeah. But they should be told that their diamond is not more eco-friendly because very likely was produced in a factory that uses a lot of resources. And it's not as valuable. If they try to resell it tomorrow, they won't get the money back. A lot of big companies now have a disclaimer saying they will not buy back the lab-grown diamond, or they can't assure the value and investment value of the lab-grown diamond. So I understand all these questions. I think it's very important to put them in the open. But as someone who values the consumer's joy of owning jewelry and diamonds, I think we should be open-minded and say if you want a lab-grown diamond and you're completely aware of the facts, but you're going to enjoy your big stone and your beautiful clarity and your beautiful cut, and why not?
A lot of people have asked me if it was a bad thing to drill into the ground. I would retort that actually growing diamond simulants in vats and chambers in these factories uses so much CO2, and so there's a lot of emissions. And also you're taking whole economies away from these very, very remote places in Africa, and often they're family-run businesses, multi-generational family-run businesses as well, which is quite sad if you think about it. I'm definitely in full agreement with you on that one. I think it's better to buy smaller, but buy natural, definitely. And for investment purposes as well.
No, that's I think it should be personal, but and that's me here speaking personally. I don't think we should be judgmental of people who decide to buy a big stone, as long as they don't tout it as my ethical choice. I think as long as they say, I wanted a big 3 carat and I paid a better price, go for it. But don't start lecturing other people and saying, my diamond is more ethical than yours. Because if your diamond came from Botswana, it means there's so many young girls who went to university thanks to the whole economy that was developed around the diamond industry in Botswana. Botswana being an absolute shining star example, where so many second generation from the diamond industry now go to university, become doctors, engineers. The wealth that has been developed thanks to the diamond industry, the natural mined diamond industry there, it's a beautiful story. So I think, you know, if we want to talk about ethics, I think that's a beautiful story. And I think we should just, you know, have the full information and especially tell the full information to consumers, and retailers should say it, and feel good about your diamonds and enjoy them. And I think the most important is that people buy diamonds, that they love diamonds.
We spoke previously, and you said to me that when you took on the job as editor-in-chief of the Rappaport magazine, you weren't particularly obsessed with diamonds.
Yes. I turned down the job, actually. I didn't want it. So I tried to make it short, but I got a phone call from a recruiter 2 weeks, even maybe 1 week before my wedding. That was 2016, December, just before Hanukkah. And I almost put the phone down on her. I said, look, I'm not interested in a job right now. I'm getting married in a week. And also a diamond company? Really? I just need to tell my background is writing about travel and luxury travel. So it felt like very far from it, you know? And then they called me not from the recruiter, but from Rapaport. And they said, oh, mazel tov, we can wait after your wedding to have you for the interview, which I said, that's very nice. So they set a date. I put it in a calendar, forgot about it, had a wedding, the friends over, the party. And the day of the interview, I felt I don't want to go. Actually, I couldn't care less. So I actually called. I said, I'm not feeling so well. Thank you. And I thought that was the end of it. And at the time, the publisher, John Costello, who I'll always be grateful for, called me and he said, I hope you feel better. Can we find another day? And I was so surprised. And I thought he was so gracious. I thought, no, I would be rude. So I actually went to the interview, not motivated, but I thought, let's finish it. And they've been so gracious about it. And John told me, we're moving the magazine from New York to Israel. We're going to redesign it. This is my vision for Rapaport. This is how I want to bring Rapaport to another level of professionalism in terms of news. I just want to be very precise about that. Rapaport was doing a great job in terms of trading platform, which is Rapnet, the price list, auction. They have different other branches, but the information services needed a bit of a refresh. And John Costello, that was his mission. And he wanted someone. I'd worked in London for 13 years. I have a degree in journalism. And he liked my way of writing. And we really, really clicked. And then I went to another interview. I started reading the De Beers Insight report, which is the benchmark knowing what's happening in the industry. I did all this research online. And suddenly the diamond industry, which I thought was this narrow, very small market, became, wow, it's about politics, economy, culture, luxury, obviously, but in a broader sense, about art, savoir-faire, craftsmanship, that involves so many things. History, I love history. My degree is in history and art history. Suddenly, it just connected so many things, and it became the big passion of my life the past 7 years. And I always said, it's like this blonde date where you go, oh, gosh, another sloppy date. And you end up marrying the guy. That was my story with Rapaport and the diamond industry, really.
Wine is a little bit like that as well. You've got geology, history, economies. There's a halo effect that it has. You move to Israel. You get married. You continue on this wonderful job. You get quite obsessed with diamonds. And you've been living there ever since. Are you happy?
Malia is the best decision I've ever made. By far, because first it was fulfilling a dream, but it just, I think like all these blessings opened the day I landed at Ben Gurion. It was the 14th of January, 2014. So it's very easy. If you want my password for most of my thing, now I gave it to you. It's the easiest code ever. Take my bank account. But it was just everything opened, you know, like I think first I felt home. I felt I had arrived home here in Israel. And I love London. We discussed it. We both lived in London. Most of my best friends are in London. I studied there. I worked there. Loved it. I still love it. But maybe it was never home, you know? And I arrived here. I lived in Tel Aviv. So it was just, it was home. I love Jerusalem, but I always felt I wanted to live in Tel Aviv because it was international and it was more mixed and it was perfect for me. And yeah, I met the love of my life here. I got this job which really fulfilled me beyond all my expectations. If you had told me the day I met John Costello and he, you know, we discussed the job, it would grow into such a passion. The people I've met in the industry, the friends I've made, the projects I've worked on, you know, we launched a podcast, we did videos, I got obsessed with social media, like things I've never done before. It really challenged me and I had this amazing white space. And he challenged me as a manager of people as well. I had a team, you know, I had a big team, which before I was an editor, but only with one person. So he was a full team, international team with all contributors. It really pushed me. And I think, yeah, it was the fact of being in Israel. And I have two beautiful daughters. You know, to have my kids speaking Hebrew, for me, it's like, wow, this is so, so great. So I feel very, very happy. And I know that was the best single ticket I ever took. The LL flight was the best. That was the best ever.
You've been living in Israel ever since. You just seem so poised and so French and such a lady. I just wonder how it is living in the rough and tumble of Tel Aviv. How does it not eat you up?
I look very poised, but you can ask all my friends in the diamond industry. I know how to get by. I'm a tough cookie behind. A friend of mine, a colleague, said I was, a hand of steel in a glove of velvet. But I tell you, it's at the beginning, you think, oh my gosh, the Israelis, they're shouting, they're screaming. It's so difficult. Everything is difficult. You need to argue to get something so simple. And you get in a groove, but there's also so much goodness. People, you know, it's like people will argue with you and they will hug you a second later, or they will shout at you. But if you need help, they will also help you.
After October 7th, tell me what your experience was and how have you felt? Did it make you want to move? Did it make you want to move back to London or to Bordeaux or to Paris? How was it for you?
Oh, wow. So I'll answer your last question first. I never, ever considered moving out of Israel after the 7th of October. Didn't cross my mind. It was suggested a lot. We had a lot of very caring friends from all over the world, Jewish, not Jewish, sending messages, offering their home, which I will be eternally grateful for, really. So many people calling, saying, my house is not big, but you're always welcome to come here with the kids and your husband, which I thought was beautiful. But it was never an option. It was really, I felt like we're in it together. We went through something traumatic. I don't know if the word is even strong enough, but that was very, I think, a life-changing experience in terms of how we saw our safety, what happened that day, the wounds, the pain, the heartbreaks. So I felt we had to be here. And you know, and also it's something that I've discussed a lot. I want to say it for your listeners that I'm in a very privileged position. I live in Ramat Gan, which is close to Tel Aviv. It's the suburb. My husband is not serving in reserve duty because he's too old. So compared to a lot of families that suddenly saw their husband going to the army, doing reserve duty or serving in the army if they're younger, or if they're in different levels of the army. So we stayed as a family unit in our home. Since the 7th of October, we haven't moved. Families from the north have lost their house. We're talking about 300,000 people who have been displaced since October 2023. The people in the south have been displaced. They went through the horror of the 7th of October. So I'm in this position as well. I want to say it very clearly that I kept my job. My husband kept his job. My kids didn't go to nurseries for a few weeks after the 7th, like all the kids in the country, but they went back into their routine. So I'm talking from a place of privilege. I just want to say that. If I had been in the north of the country or in the south, maybe I would have left Israel. I don't know. I really don't know. I just want to say that. And a lot of people in the center of the country decided to go abroad to their family, to their friends, because they couldn't deal with the pressure. And I think we need to be very mindful of them because they also made a very, very big choice to leave their home, to leave their routine. So, but for me, it was obvious I had to be here. I had to be here with the people. I'm very proud that my little daughters, they learn how to say prayers for the soldiers, for the hostages. They get gifts for the soldiers. It's part of their life, you know. They feel part of a nation and a country. So there will be trauma for sure. But I feel like, you know, I'm sure my trauma will be less than so many others. But I feel for them, and I feel like we needed to be all together in it. That's my answer to you.
You went to the Tel HaShomer Hospital as well to visit some of the heavily wounded soldiers. Can you explain a little bit about that experience?
Oh, Marielle, oh, it's so many people say it's going to be depressing, it's going to be intense. And it wasn't. It's intense and it's heartbreaking. We saw so many people with missing limbs, head injuries, on wheelchairs. Some of them, we don't know if they will ever walk again. Some of them with cognitive difficulties, but But at the same time, I was there with a few friends. We left feeling there was so much goodness. We only saw people smiling to us. We visited them. We brought them cakes and drinks and little gifts. We just wanted to say thank you. Thank you so much for having done that for you. And, you know, I think my heart was outpouring with gratitude to them and their families, because it's thanks to them that I'm safe in my home, you know, and I will never forget. We're safe in our home, the rest of the country, because you have young men and women. We saw women also with missing limbs and, you know, injuries from being soldiers in the army. It's thanks to them. They gave us something that is our safety, is our survival. But you felt this strength in them. You felt like, you know, and also big, 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 wow, admiration to all the staff in the hospital, what they've been seeing since the 7th of October and before, because it's not the first time that Israel is under attack. But there was a young man who was on a wheelchair with his best friend from nursery school who comes to visit him every single day. And he told us it's not from the 7th of October or this war, it's from 2009, Gaza. So this young man has been on a wheelchair, you know, and it puts us back as well. It didn't start on the 7th of October. But to go back to Tel HaShomer, it wasn't a place of sadness. It was a place of strength and hope in the future. Some people were saying, jokingly but seriously, I will run a marathon in a year. And, you know, some of the staff told us one of the soldiers arrived here in October with the tubes and his body completely, we thought that was it, but they helped him and he had run his marathon a week before our visit. And, you know, and you feel it. You feel this strength. You feel this solidarity. You feel the solidarity between the hospital staff, the carer, the families that go there every day, the friends. And something very, very important, I think I want to mention, the staff is not just Jews. There are a lot of Arab Israelis working in the hospital as well. And, you know, and you feel there's a bond between them because everyone is in Israel and is suffering from the war. The war is not just affecting one or the other population. Everyone is in it. So it was also very touching to see that and to see this aspect of the hospital life.
There's definitely an Israeli resilience that comes out. Do you have hope for Israel? Do you have hope for the end of this war?
I pray for the end of this war, like all of us. But this war can only end once we have all the hostages back. That's not negotiable, this one. And once we know that we're going to be safe, that's just that this time we cannot let another 7th of October. So whatever it takes, I think I'm very much of the, it needs to be a complete victory this time. That's me. But hostages need to be back. That's the priority, obviously. That's not even a question. So once we know they're back, I think our national and international, because, you know, when we say national, every single Jew, I think, in the world has been with us. We feel it. I think the Israelis feel this amazing support coming from diaspora, you know, people who gave money, their time, who travel, who are so vocal about the fate of the hostages. So we feel it. So I'm hopeful. I just pray for the hostages that they will come back. I will pray also, I want our soldiers, I don't want to hear more bad news from the soldiers. And I think after that, we hope for a better future. But right now it's difficult. It's difficult to be optimistic. It's difficult to be positive and say yes. Because if you had told me a year in October that this thing would last for so long, I don't know, but I feel I have so much faith in our people, in our country, because this, you know, there's been so much suffering, but there's been so much goodness and greatness coming together and people being good and being resilient. So I think we'll be good. I think once we are out of this horror, it will be good.
Before we wrap up, I just want to ask you, what makes you feel so connected to Israel?
It's something inside. You can't really explain it. You know, is it the land? Is it the energy of this land? Is the our Jewish history? It's our Jewish future. I think it's, for me, it's even more connected to the future. you know, you can go to the mountains and say, oh, this is where it happened in the Bible, and this is this place in the Bible, which all this, you feel it. But it's more the future. I think, you know, it's, it feels like it's our home. It's our ancestral home, but it's the home that we're building for the future of the next generations. So all this that we had to go through, we're still a very young country. We are an old country, but a young country from 1948, you know, like the structure, the modern. The, and look at everything we've achieved, everything people achieved in very hard conditions, the malaria-infested fields, Holocaust survivors coming with nothing. And look at how far we've gone, the high-tech scene here. I mean, if you go to Tel Aviv, it compares to a lot of, you know, modern cities, the level of the hotels, the restaurants, the international vibe of the places. And at the same time, it's a very Israeli place. You know, you go to a small village, you go to a small town, it's very Israeli. I think it's our future. I believe that it's, I feel very strongly, and now that I have kids as well, Israeli kids who speak Hebrew as their first language, even if we speak French as well, I feel deeply connected. And I think since the 7th of October, I feel even more connected to Israel. It feels like there's no other home for me and my family. So yes, that's why I have to be hopeful that it's going to go well.
Thank you so much, Sonia Esther Soltani, for coming on SBS Hebrew. It's been a delight.
Thank you so much, Marielle, for having me and giving me this opportunity to share my little life experience. Thank you. עקבו אחרינו והפיצו אותנו דרך דף הפייסבוק שלנו.